All right, welcome back. This is Eric Elveson, and today, for a second time on the podcast, I'm with John Eckert, who is professor of education at Wheaton College. John's research includes teaching effectiveness, teacher preparation, teacher evaluation, and teacher compensation. In addition to his work at Wheaton, he is a research consultant for the Center for Teaching Quality, and he has also consulted with the National Institute for Excellence in Teaching and the U.S. Department of Education. You can find his recent research, which I write about in some of my blogs, on collective leadership in his new book, Leading Together, Teachers and Administrators Improving Student Outcomes. So, John, I'm going to go right into a quote from your book where you say, educators spend too much time down in the weeds worrying, who is a leader? Who is not a leader? Is a leader defined by a position? Many times these conversations are driven by contracts and collective bargaining language that separates teachers and administrators. These can be important questions, but they are not the questions that will actually improve education. One of the primary attributes of great school leaders, both administrators and teachers, is the fact that they don't define, they do. They get things done. And in your research and, you know, in your work now, and what are you seeing as leaders rethink, you know, the profession, rethink their faculties, rethink schools? What are you seeing that is changing and that is successful?
So the most impactful leaders that we found when we were doing research on the book, a research assistant and I, one of the things that kept coming up was that we asked this one question, is leadership more about the person or the work? And everybody's always in a little bit of a conundrum over that because, you know, it's a little bit of both. But the question is, which one is it more about? The most impactful leaders that we interviewed, there were 81 of them, administrators and teacher leaders from around the country. The most impactful ones said that it was about the work. And this is the point about not defining and just doing. They were less concerned about who was or who wasn't a leader and more concerned with what needed to get done. And so they just started doing it. And then they became the de facto leaders because they were doing the work. And what I think is the cause of that, that they're more impactful because of that, is they don't worry about whether or not they're qualified. They don't worry about whether or not other people will respect them. They don't worry about whether or not they have a right to be doing the work. They just do it. And so in schools where conditions are such that principals, assistant principals, administrators support that kind of leadership from teachers, I think a lot more gets done. And it's a lot more effective place to work. And so I think it makes a healthier culture and leads to more positive student outcomes because a lot of the work that the teachers are doing with administrators is in support of needs that are identified by teachers that are close to the classroom issues that are bubbling up from there.
So in that, you know, in that quote, you talk about the conditions, contracts, collective bargaining, some of the traditional history of, you know, even, you know, when the NEA in particular made the decision to separate administrators and teachers. Like, how are you seeing people in this collective leadership sense begin to bridge the gap between, you know, the traditional structures of you're a teacher, you're an administrator? Are you seeing changes within schools and within the context of the profession that creates a more multidimensional nature to the work, the opportunities, you know, and then just the growth for people within the profession?
I think there's a recognition in the research and more broadly that collective leadership, the leadership of teachers and administrators together, in addition to community members and students, is the way to go. I think that's been acknowledged, and I think a lot of people would give lip service to that. I also think that in some contexts, it's taken much more seriously than others. And so in the book, I look at a rural school, a suburban school, and an urban school, and the way that collective leadership development plays out is very different across all three contexts. So in the rural school, which is probably almost the most interesting on this. There are only 26 full-time teachers, and the superintendent is in a trailer in the parking lot of the high school. That's where his office is, because they're pouring all their resources into the schools. And so everything the superintendent and the principal do at that high school are in support of the ideas that are bubbling up from the classroom. And so they haven't actually changed much structurally to their compensation plans. They haven't changed anything contractually. It's just an acknowledgement that if they're going to get anything done, it's going to have to come from the 26 teachers, because their enrollment shrinking. They don't have a lot of staff. They have a lot of teachers that are the only teachers in their subject area. But of those 26 teachers, six of them are nationally board certified, and two of them were up for State Teacher of the Year in Illinois. So there's a lot of capacity there. And these teachers are doing a lot that goes beyond the contract. Now, as a profession, that's not necessarily a great thing, because you want people being compensated for the work that they do. That's part of being a professional. One of the things that's great about teaching, but it's also its greatest curse, going back to the early 1800s, there's this idea of missionary teachers, that we do these things out of a sense of calling and mission, and then don't necessarily need to be compensated for it. So in the end, education's gotten a discount for hundreds of years from getting, especially women, who have been very talented and capable of a lot, when they were pigeonholed into education or nursing as the key vocations, which, you know, began to change in the 60s and 70s. But we've gotten great teachers because of that, and we have not paid them professionally, which is ultimately why unions started up. And so that separation between administrators and teachers, there was a reason why some of that made sense in collective bargaining and the way they move things forward. But now, as we look at trying to blur those lines between administrators and teachers, the contract can sometimes be problematic, because it doesn't give flexibility for how you want to pay teachers differently, how administrators might be in the classroom some teaching, and how teachers might be doing some administrative duties. Those very distinct separations can be a problem. Saw that some in the urban school, and saw it a little bit in suburban school, but savvy principals and teachers were finding ways around that. And sometimes the contracts catch up.
So, you know, even when you talk about pay, and, you know, when I talk with educators and school leaders, you know, we do know there's a teacher shortage, and maybe I'll ask you a final question when we close out on that, but Or you know, if I'm trying to improve the quality of my faculty, you know, people will come up with these crazy ideas on how to pay their teachers. You know, they come up with merit pay, and you've done some of the research on merit pay results, and, you know, they'll come up with all these just these plans, career ladders, and all this to try to solve either, you know, their shortage issues or their quality issues. You know, how is some of the work that you've done on strategic compensation connected with creating the quality that you're looking at? And then where does strategic compensation help? And then where is it, you know, sometimes people's desires with the money issue misguided?
Yeah, so it's a good question and a complex one, so I'll try to keep the answer as short as possible. But I do like the term strategic compensation, because I think it gets at the heart of the issue. The main reason why career ladders and some of these other pay initiatives haven't worked in the research is they're really technical solutions to adaptive challenges. So ultimately, these people have good intentions of trying to pay teachers for the kind of work that's most meaningful for students and for school improvement. And the issue is they don't either A, have enough resources to do it, or B, they don't have the kind of flexibility to make the system work for the context in which they're located. And so it takes really thoughtful work around how to use scarce resources in as efficient way as possible. Because, I mean, another thing that teachers sometimes do that shoots them in the foot is say they don't go into teaching for the money, but many teachers leave for the money, and research bears that out. And so if we started paying teachers $200,000 a year, that would fundamentally change the makeup, the recruitment and retention of teachers in this country. Now, obviously, we're not going to do that, because public schools are funded through tax dollars, and taxpayers aren't going to be putting up with that kind of tax rate increase. So in the end, you have to move around what limited resources you have. And if the average teacher salary in the country is $56,000, there's not a ton of latitude for how to use that more creatively. So sometimes we make really cheap proxies for quality. We're like, oh, we'll give you an extra $1,000 for this. And then it starts to feel almost insulting. And it can become demotivating if you are starting to extrinsically motivate something that had been being done intrinsically out of that sense of mission that teachers have. So there's this fine line of how you do it. The one example I'll give you on strategic compensation where I feel like it worked pretty well, spent 2 years working with a district outside in the Chicagoland area, and we had 9 members of the teachers union and 9 administrators and the superintendent sitting on a team working for 2 years for trying to figure out how to use compensation more strategically. And it was a lot of back and forth. We did research together on what worked, what didn't work. We made some stipulations that we weren't going to go to pay for test scores from the beginning. That was put up front, that was overly simplistic and also really complicated for teachers that didn't have test scores in a state like Illinois, where the state test keeps changing. And so, you know, trying to peg a compensation structure to that's a problem, because what we wanted to avoid was giving too much consequential validity to any measure that seemed like it didn't deserve that kind of consequential validity. And so we came up with some ways to, you know, acknowledge the work teachers were doing by getting additional education through advanced degrees, micro-credentials, additional leadership work they took on in the schools. You take on leadership work, you get compensated for it, to the point about teachers being professionals. If we're professionals we do additional work, there should be compensation for that. Not in a hourly rate kind of thing, but as a salaried component of the leadership work that teachers need to do. And we made some progress. Now that contract, that recommendation went forward, is being collectively bargained now, and we'll see this summer how that comes out in the contract language. But it was a very productive 2 years where I think teachers and administrators learned with and from each other and came out with a pretty good recommendation that everybody was happy with. And we finished the process 2 months early. So it is possible to do this in a meaningful way. Now we'll see what kind of impact it has if it gets implemented in the next contract. But that was an encouraging example of
how many places will actually spend 2 years though doing that sort of work?
Well, the good thing about it, and I didn't have anything to do with this part of it, they signed the contract. The union signed the contract. Well, the teachers association signed the contract. And then the agreement was they would no longer, they had to change the way compensation was done. And so the agreement was built in that there would be this 2 year committee that would put together a recommendation. So I think it can be done in public schools where you're working on 3 year contracts. You just say, okay, here's what we're doing now. For the next one, we've got to put the time in. And all these, the administrators and teachers, they were not compensated at all for their time. They just worked together on it. So it did not actually, it cost in human resources and time, but it didn't have a compensation component to it for the 18 people involved in the team. So it's possible, but I think you have to have some foresight that, okay, we're going to sign this contract, and before the next one, we're going to have something different.
And you've talked about this with me before, but you know, how often is it that, you know, that strategic compensation work or some of that redesign that goes with some of these collective leadership ideas that, you know, people, if they're not, you know, if they're not thoughtful, like the dollar amounts, because, you know, we kind of think pie in the sky and all those, the dollar amounts get away from us. Mm. And that, you know, we come up with all these grand ideas and then all of a sudden it's, you know, you're talking about $5 million extra. You know, and you're not working with the same pool of money or resources that are available. I mean, what, and you've talked about, you know, when people get an influx of money, you know, they go through these changes, but then when that influx of money goes away, you know, they just go back to the old systems. You know, so how do you avoid, you know, that idea of, you know, hey, we're going to do this, this, and this, but we don't necessarily have added resources?
So there's this great principle called equifinality, that there are many paths to a positive outcome. And so, and this isn't a cop-out answer, it's just the reality. Every place is constrained and supported by the context in which it's located. And so, you know, this district I was working with was a suburban district. They were, the board was committed to not adding any additional money to the pot. And so this, going in, I was a little bit skeptical because, you know, you cited the places where they add money. I studied the teacher incentive fund from the U.S. Department of Ed. It's now, I think they put in over $2 billion in districts to figure out ways to pay teachers differently in their five-year grants. And the toughest thing about them is sustaining them, because you get an additional $40 million in. Well, that makes things different over the course of those 5 years. But then how do you keep funding the things that make the most difference? I think the key in those situations, if you do get an influx of cash, is to really look at what's making the most difference and what you can't live without. And so that's, to me, that kind of teacher leadership, collective leadership, spreading of expertise. And that's the part that people don't want to let go of. And that doesn't necessarily have to cost a ton of money. You do have to be really careful if you start rolling out compensation structures that you put the money where you care about it the most, where you think it'll have the most impact. And that's why that two-year process is so important. The teachers and administrators sat down together and said, hey, we know we don't have a lot of extra money, but we might have some things here and here that we don't think are having as much impact. Maybe we can shift it here. And that makes it more likely to be sustained because they haven't actually increased the bottom line. And so those are hard, hard conversations, because obviously people have differences of opinion, but a lot can be learned from those conversations.
So let me ask one last question, you know, because you've been right. CTQ has been writing a series on the teacher shortage. And, you know, I know that you've been a part of that. How severe is the teacher shortage? And, you know, what have you learned even through this blog series that maybe you didn't know before?
Yeah, so this was a partnership blog series with the Learning Policy Institute at Stanford, who had done a lot of research on the impact of teacher shortages. And, you know, I just finished the wrap-up blog. It'll get posted on Monday. The thing I see happening, you get pushback on the teacher shortage issue, especially from more libertarian or conservative-leaning education experts, and they're like, "Well, this isn't a national problem. At most, it's a regional problem, or it's a subject-specific problem." But to me, that is a national problem, because it's indicative. The teacher shortage is indicative of much deeper issues. And so if it's not across the board the same for everyone, that means there are inequities in who it's impacting. And so students in poverty, special ed students, math and science students in California, students in Arizona, students in New Mexico, they're being disproportionately impacted by the teacher shortage. And so I think we have to address some of the root issues there. And one of them is the way our country views teaching right now. And it's not a particularly healthy view of teaching as a profession, so that needs to change. Some of it's the way we fund schools. I'm in Illinois, where we have a 4-to-1 funding disparity between districts that spend the most on education and those who spend the least. And it's not the difference between North Shore Chicago and Chicago Public Schools. It's downstate Illinois and North Shore Chicago, where the funding differences are so great. Those aren't easy solutions, because living in Winnetka is expensive. You know, how do you pay teachers to live there? You're dealing with that in San Jose. And so we see these crazy technical solutions being applied, tiny houses for teachers. So the basic, in my blog, I write this, I have this line. It's like, I can hear the pitch now. Come to the profession that makes all others possible, and here's 300 square feet of living space. Maybe. I mean, these tiny houses may only be 150. I may be exaggerating. But, I mean, that's a horrific way to solve the teacher shortage in any kind of meaningful way. But that one's one of the most egregious technical solutions I've seen to a real problem, and people are genuinely trying to solve it, but that's not going to do it. That just continues to deprofessionalize what we do.
Well, John, yeah, I look forward, and I'll link that blog to this podcast and different things, but I appreciate the conversation again, and, you know, look forward to, you know, connecting and having some of these conversations about collective leadership, strategic compensation, and just our profession. So thanks.